This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker. It's a Friday night, which means I'm joined by Aaron Bastani. Aaron, World War III has not yet begun. Are you feeling some relief this afternoon, or are you feeling somewhat nervous about what might come next?
I'm somewhat relieved. I think the worst case scenario with regards to Israel-Iran seems to have just chilled out for a little bit, as is often the case. Problem is, Michael, things only need to go drastically wrong once, and you do get something very significant. That's, after all, the story of World War I. So, yeah, we shouldn't take it lightly, but for now, things could be much worse.
Yeah, I think things oddly seem a little bit better today than they did yesterday or at the start of the week when it comes to sort of regional conflagrations. Straight into that first story. Israel last night launched a rocket attack on Iran. Israel hasn't confirmed it. They never do, but US officials have. And this footage of explosions over the Iranian city of Isfahan has been circulating widely, though Reuters have been unable to verify it. According to the Americans, Israel launched a long-range missile into Iran, but the Iranians have described the incident as a drone attack. And Iranian state media has been downplaying the significance. This is part of a report from the Iranian-owned Press TV.
I would suggest our viewers, if they want to have a good laugh, they can check social media reports from citizens who are there, who are actually making fun of all the commotion that was made by Israeli media about a possible attack.
Okay, so at this point, Gisu, there's nothing to indicate or corroborate that there is, when it comes to sounds over Isfahan, that there are foreign agents involved, that it was any kind of quote-unquote attack.
Definitely. There is nothing out of the ordinary happening. Like I said before, obviously, because of the threats coming from the part of Israelis and the rhetoric, obviously Iran is on high alert right now. And that high alert caused those small drones, of course, to trigger the alert system. And that's why those explosions were heard. But that, according to the images that we're receiving from the city of Isfahan and also from social media reports that we're receiving from Iranian citizens living in Isfahan and all the parts near the nuclear facilities there, everything is completely normal. We're also receiving some live images right now. You can see on the screen that in Isfahan, everything is just based on normal. It's a normal Friday, a weekend, and people are enjoying the weekend.
People are enjoying the weekend. Everything's completely normal. Everything's completely fine. That seemed like a pundit and a news channel that wanted to, I suppose, underplay what had happened or suggest that there was no big deal. Now, many people interpreted that as positive because it suggests that they won't feel pressure to retaliate. And the International Atomic Energy Agency has confirmed that no damage has been done to Iran's nuclear sites. That was a worry because where the rocket attacks took place, it is nearby, both military installations and nuclear installations, but seems that none of them have been seriously hit and the nuclear sites not hit at all. Benjamin Netanyahu and the Ayatollah Khamenei are yet to comment on the attack. I'm not sure they ever will. And Israeli and Iranian governments have said little publicly. But a senior Iranian official has told Reuters there are no immediate plans to retaliate. So it seems like this is not going to push us into a World War III at this point. However, some in the Israeli regime are less pleased about a potential climb down from a world war. On Twitter, far-right security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir described the attack as feeble. Though, as you can see, Google translates his post literally to scarecrow. But we're told feeble is one word that's been used. Other people are saying lame. Obviously, I can't speak Hebrew. Opposition leader Yair Lapid took to Twitter to condemn that comment. So he said, never before has a minister in the defense cabinet done such heavy damage to the country's security, its image, and its international status. In an unforgivable tweet of one word, Ben-Gvir managed to mock and shame Israel from Tehran to Washington. So Ben-Gvir sort of doing that tweet was controversial in Israel. One, because they're never supposed to comment on whether or not they have carried out these attacks. Now, everyone knows this was Israel, but as you'll have seen in stories before, they never say it was them. And two, he's clearly sort of breaking ranks with the government of which he is part. So Yair Lapid, not happy with Ben-Gvir, neither are Israel's international allies. They don't seem to want this to escalate. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said this after a meeting of G7 foreign ministers in Italy.
First, the G7 condemned the unprecedented Iranian attack on Israel. Unprecedented in scope and scale. Scope because it was a direct attack on Israel from Iran. Scale because it involved more than 300 munitions, including ballistic missiles. We're committed to Israel's security. We're also committed to de-escalating, to trying to bring this tension to a close. Even as we've been dealing with the conflict in the Middle East and, again, the unprecedented attack by Iran on Israel, we've remained intensely focused on Gaza. We urge the rapid implementation of Israel's humanitarian assistance commitments. More aid, more crossings, better deconfliction, better distribution of the assistance to all who need it. We've seen important steps over the last couple of weeks with more crossings opening, more aid getting in, more aid getting around. But we need to see sustained results. And we need, in particular, to make sure that there is distribution throughout Gaza. We also focused on the imperative of getting to a ceasefire with the release of hostages. Such a ceasefire would facilitate the dramatic expansion in humanitarian assistance. It would also let Gazans return to the north, those who've been displaced from the north. The only thing standing between the Gazan people and a ceasefire is Hamas. It's rejected generous proposals from Israel. It seems more interested in a regional conflict than it is in a ceasefire that would immediately improve the lives of the Palestinian people.
So, of course, that generous proposal that's been made to Hamas is, can you release all the hostages? Then we'll have a small pause in fighting before completely destroying you. So I'm not sure if sort of many organizations on the international stage would find that a generous proposal, but that's how the United States are framing it. Aaron, what do you think's happened here? I mean, it does seem like Israel felt they had to respond, but they've responded in, you know, not a particularly extreme way. It doesn't look like we're heading to direct war between Iran and Israel.
Well, there is that adage, isn't there, Michael? Speak quietly and hold or shake a big stick. And that tends to be the smartest way to conduct oneself in one's personal affairs or indeed in international affairs. Iran, so far, is both speaking loudly and shaking a big stick. I think this was the single largest assault using ballistic missiles in human history. That's quite significant. None got through, but that really shows you the scale of what's happening. People are trying to play it down. That's very significant. Drones, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. So none got through. As we spoke about last week, that still cost the Israelis maybe more than $1 billion because Iron Dome isn't, of course, free. And it's not cheap either. And the Israelis have done this initial response. I suspect we'll also just see a slow burn, Michael, over the coming weeks, coming months. And that's not new. We've seen a slow burn in terms of how these two regimes treat one another for years. You know, Iran's nuclear program has been massively hindered by the fact that Israel has been murdering civilian scientists in the streets for a long time. I mean, a decade plus. So expect more things like that, things like the Stuxnet assault, low-level assaults on infrastructure, military infrastructure in particular, but maybe civilian too. And I think it makes sense for the Israelis to not escalate it so visibly and overtly right now and probably resort to that kind of thing. That's how Mossad and the Israeli state has generally conducted its extraterritorial affairs. It's been using covert means. It's used things you might call terrorism, for instance, terrorist tactics, the kinds of tactics you would normally associate with a non-state actor. And I suspect that's what will happen next. What you can be assured of is that anybody who's senior in the Revolutionary Guard, particularly in the Quds Force serving overseas, particularly in Syria, Iraq, they will be watching their step because a lot of those people's safety right now will be front and center of the regime's mind in Tehran. And I wouldn't be surprised particularly if you saw a few more people being bumped off, not quite as senior as what we saw in the consulate in Damascus. Of course, that was the most senior Iranian officer in the Levant. But I think you'll see more things like that from the Israelis. That's not for media consumption. That's just to send a signal to the Iranians, we're not going away.
Yeah, because I mean, it is interesting because I suppose the way we had been talking about that Israeli attack on the consulate and sort of speaking to experts like Trita Parsi, one of the sort of theories that had been floating around is that Israel really wanted a war with Iran. They saw this as an opportunity to expand the war, to bring the United States directly into the conflict, and then they could, you know, achieve their maximalist aims in Gaza sort of under the cover of a much larger conflict. This particular action by Israel doesn't make it seem as if that is what they were aiming for the whole time. You know, it could have been the case that Israel could have done something more provocative than they have done right now. So I suppose, do you think we need to recalibrate some of those assumptions or some of those sort of working theories that we might have had?
I don't think so. I think there's multiple factions in the Israeli state, obviously, as you saw with the statements made by certain members of the cabinet. And I don't think it's an either or. I think, you know, it's perfectly plausible for the IDF to both prepare for low intensity warfare of the kind that we've seen, which is what that is. If you're going around killing civilian scientists in the streets of Tehran on a motorcycle and with a machine gun, that's low level warfare, or Stuxnet virus trying to destroy military infrastructure, that's low level warfare. I think it's possible to say that the IDF both want to continue with that strategy, which has been very fruitful for them. You know, if Iran has developed nuclear weapons, there's not many warheads, that's for sure. But at the same time, I think you want, I still, and this is what we were talking about last week, I still think that they want to create major incentives to the US to stay in the region. What does that look like? It's very finely calibrated, you know. I mean, the ideal scenario for them is really that a bunch of Arab capitals turn against Iran. And actually, you know, the conflict really isn't just between Israel and Iran, but also between the Saudis, the UAE, Iraq. That's far less likely. So it's a very tough one for the Israelis, Michael. You know, we have this impasse at the moment. On the one hand, Iran isn't technologically advanced enough to really wage war on Israel. On the other hand, Israel is nowhere near large enough to wage war on Iran. They have asymmetries in completely different areas. Israel, 10 million people. Iran, 90 million people. Israel, extraordinary military-industrial complex with regards to advanced technologies. Iran, less so, but is a huge producer of steel. It's if you take out Germany, I think it's larger than any European country with regards to the production of steel. Obviously, massive hydrocarbon exporter. In the context of a total war, of a mass mobilization, Iran would probably give Israel a hiding. Of course, Israel has nuclear weapons. It has F-35s. They would say it won't get that far. So you have these strange asymmetries between these two countries where actually they're peer-level competitors, but in completely different areas of geopolitics, of warfare. So trying to predict how that works its way out or how Israel might try and keep the US embroiled in the region is a great question. And I would say as well, Michael, it's not something we get regular insights into in the English-speaking world, but there are clearly people in the IDF who aren't as stupid as the right-wing political class in Israel. That's not to say they're good people. That's not to say they're wonderful people or they don't want to take territory from Palestinians. I think the West Bank is low-hanging fruit for many of them. But ultimately, yes, many of those people believe in a greater Israel. But I think also they probably think that project is one that will take centuries, decades, you know, at least. Whereas people like Ben-Gavir, Smotrich, these two parties in the coalition with Netanyahu, you know, they want to do that in the next 6 months, the next year, the next 5 years, Israel Katz, the foreign minister. And I think there's a tension there as well. How quickly do you want to provoke a war with Iran? How quickly do you want to try and undertake your maximalist political ambitions, which is, of course, this greater Israel, take the West Bank, maybe give Gaza to Egypt? That is the position, for instance, of somebody like Israel Katz, who is the Israeli foreign minister. He's not some nobody schmuck, you know, creating viral content on social media. He is right there next to Netanyahu making decisions.
And let's just talk about, I suppose, one final theory about sort of the strategic interests or the strategic game playing that we might be witnessing. So there were reports earlier in the week that Joe Biden had said to Netanyahu, look, I don't want you to get into a wider war with Iran because that's going to be a disaster for American interests in the region more generally. So if you promise not to retaliate in a sort of particularly strong way towards Iran, then I will let you invade Rafah. This been denied, in fact, by the Americans. I don't think sort of anyone on the record have said this was the case, but it was widely reported. And I suppose that could be maybe a win that Israel have got out of this. If they sort of, they started a conflict with Iran, they pulled back from the brink, but they used it as a sort of negotiating chip to tell the Americans, you can't stop us doing Rafah. Let us do Rafah and we won't drag the whole world into World War III. Do you think there could be anything there?
I think that's right. And look, this is Israel. If you look at Israel and how it's operated as a state since 1948, the one thing they definitely do, Michael, is revenge. They definitely do revenge. So I think there will be revenge against Iran for even daring. By the way, this starts with Israel with regards to it. I'm not suggesting for one moment this was catalyzed by Iran. This was started by Israel in the bombing of a consulate diplomatic building, that sovereign Iranian territory. Seven Syrians die, I think, and six Iranian nationals die, or the other way around, 13 people died. So Iran daring to respond in the manner that it did, I think, has really upset lots of people in Tel Aviv. And to repeat, Michael, the attack by Iran, allegedly using relatively outdated military technology, allegedly, you know, there are three categories, for instance, of Shahab, medium-range ballistic missile. Apparently, they're using the old crap, which, you know, lots of it didn't really go very far. Some of it didn't even take off properly, didn't even leave Iranian airspace. It's slower, far less accurate, etc. That's the claim made by the Iranians. Despite all of that, this still, last week, was the single greatest episode of people using ballistic missiles, drones, and Scud missiles in a single moment. I think that is extraordinary. I do think that's extraordinary. Nothing like that has happened to Israel from a foreign power. Well, you could say Yom Kippur War 1973, but let's be honest, this is wholly different. I mean, it really changes the entire calculus of the region. So in answer to your question, I can believe it. We don't know, do we? But I don't really see the upside for the Americans, because the Israelis can just say, okay, no problem. And over the next 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, they return to the status quo ante. When I talk about the status quo ante, I don't mean last month. I mean the last 10, 15, 20 years of, like I say, low-level sabotage, terrorism, assassination in not just Iran, but, you know, it's near abroad too, because, of course, you have Iranian military officers in Syria, in Iraq, some in Afghanistan, presumably. And I think that's what Israel will do. So that I don't really see the upside for the US doing that. Okay, you can go to Rafah and tacitly saying you can do also this other thing, but just not so quickly. I mean, if you're the Israelis, that sounds like a deal made in heaven.
Well, the Israelis get a lot of deals made in heaven when it comes to the conditions that the United States set for them. So I wouldn't say that would rule it out as a possibility. We'll come back to Gaza and related stories later in the show. For now, though, the largest election in human history has just begun. Almost 1 billion people are eligible to vote in elections to India's parliament. And that number of voters means that the full election process will take over 6 weeks. But while the elections are impressive in scale, they don't have many observers on the edge of their seats. And that's because the BJP's Narendra Modi looks certain to win a majority. The Hindu nationalist leader has already been prime minister for 10 years, and with growth levels high, he remains incredibly popular. But opposition leaders and civil activists complain that by arresting opponents and dominating the press, Modi's style of government means this contest will be neither free nor fair. To discuss the Indian election, I spoke earlier to Alper Shah. Alper is professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics and author of The Incarcerations. So in the newly released book, Shah provides an account of 16 left-wing intellectuals and activists who were arrested by the Indian government on trumped-up terrorism charges. According to Pankaj Mishra, no finer account has been written yet about the collapse of the world's largest democracy. Now, in my interview with Alper, we did discuss Modi's threat to Indian democracy, but I began by asking her what it is that's made Narendra Modi so popular.
There's Modi himself, who presents himself as this kind of, well, a god, really. You know, he's presented himself as Lord Ram on certain occasions, which has really captured the hearts and minds of lots of Indians, as a strongman figure, anti-establishment. You know, he comes from a kind of very modest background, a chaiwala, you know, selling tea at a tea store, which is very much in contrast to the Congress Party, which is the other dominant party, which was seen very much as a dynastic party of the elites. So he's really built his movement as, you know, with plebeian origins. But at the same time, we can't understand just Modi and his kind of significant persona, his charisma, but we've also got to understand a huge history of organization on the ground, a 100-year-old history of work on the ground from the Hindu nationalist group or family of organizations, which includes the RSS, which is a paramilitary wing, the military wing of the Hindu nationalists. It includes student unions that are in every single university, farmers unions, agricultural unions. It includes how schools have been reshaped and are proposing a Hindutva agenda, a Hindu nationalist agenda. So there's a whole series of organizations that have been doing the very slow, patient work on the ground for 100 years, which have allowed Modi to flourish and which have allowed Modi and give him the support to be where he is at right now and for this election to take shape in this context where Modi is slated to win with a majority.
That's really interesting, actually. So you're saying that there's this almost this 100-year process where you've got these different civil society organizations, the RSS, which I know is sort of paramilitary and has, I think, done some fairly awful things in its past. And then you've got, I suppose, Hindu nationalist trade unions. Is that what I'm hearing? So you've got this sort of Hindu nationalist movement that's potentially made a long march through the institutions, and now it's got Modi as prime minister. It's unbeatable. Am I on the right track?
Absolutely, yeah. And you're right to point out the dark kind of past of the RSS. Actually, they're modelled on the Mussolini's black shirts, you know, the fascist black shirts. That's the model on which the RSS was shaped. And it's got, you know, all these schools everywhere, including in the diaspora in England. This is a huge organisation of different kinds of institutions infiltrating all sectors of society. And also, over the years, there has been the capture of the media, the capture of the judiciary, these last bastions of democracy in India. So a huge, you know, silencing of all forms of dissent. So there's this big, big organizational structure which has slowly infiltrated all sections of society, which really gives rise to and shapes the fact that the ways in which Modi is going to run this election.
The phrase I keep hearing is that it's not in question whether Modi will win. The only question is how big his majority will be, or how big the BJP's majority will be. And I suppose my question then is, would that matter? So does the size of Modi's majority matter for how he would govern over the next 5 years?
It does, in the sense that if he has a certain majority, he's able to do things like reshape the constitution. So he's able to make like fundamental changes in what was conceived at independence as a democratic, later on, you know, secular, federal, even socialist republic. That's how India was conceived. And many of its laws enforce that, right? And they were written up in their basis is the Indian constitution. So if he gets a really significant majority, he is able to make constitutional amendments, which would really reshape legislatively how India is structured and how it moves forward. But also, of course, you know, it gives him further strength, right? If he wins with an outright majority, a huge majority, then it strengthens what he's able to do into the future.
What does Modi want to do? What is his platform? I know it's all about sort of empowering Hindus vis-a-vis Muslims. Does he also have sort of an economic program? There has been fast growth in India recently. I know they had 8% growth last year. So I'm presuming that Modi's going to be sort of parroting that as a big success of his government. But sort of how should we understand the broader prospectus of Modi in power?
Yeah, I think Modi wants to be on the world stage. I mean, he wants to be India is going to be, you know, one of the major superpowers of the next, you know, next 100 years for him or longer, right? He wants to be taking all the key decisions at the international level. He wants to, and that's going to be on the basis of economic growth, but also it's going to be on the basis of India is one of the most, well, the most populous nation in the world. It's also what he's also proposing, of course, at home is it's based on a very exclusionary idea of a Hindu nation, which leaves out a significant 200 million Muslim minority or makes them almost strips them into second class citizens. But it's also reshaping what it means to be Indian. So India is a very diverse nation. Hinduism exists in many forms, and there are many, many other religions across India. But what he wants to create is India as a Hindu nation and going back to a mythic past that he has created, a glorious past. He's, you know, his argument, their arguments are that, you know, there's 1,000 years of colonization in India, and we are now finally going back to what was a really glorious past and a new kind of man who is going to be this Hindu superman, you know, a super race that's going to rule India and rule the world. So there's a very, very, very ambitious, very big agenda, which is a very exclusionary agenda at two.
In terms of democracy, so as far as I understand it, this election is democratic in the sense that the voting isn't going to be rigged. The reason Modi will win is because he is genuinely very popular among Indian people. But I also hear lots of people say democracy is under threat. So I suppose, could you talk about the ways in which Indian democracy is under threat? And, you know, I suppose some people concerned this will be India's last democratic election because all of the democratic norms are being eroded.
Well, I think we've had a silent takeover and silencing of all forms of opposition, right? So I think we should question whether this is a free and fair election. We've got chief ministers of states, two chief ministers in prison, imprisoned. We've got all kinds of democratic rights activists on the ground in prison. We've got journalists in prison. We've got a takeover of the judiciary, right, or by the institutions of the Hindu right. We've got a silencing of all forms of civil liberties going on in India. So, you know, yes, we're going to have the ritual of elections. Yes, more than 900 million voters are eligible to vote as of today. But that process of voting has become a ritual. You know, it's a ritual of democracy. What's actually happened in India on the ground is a very, very, very rapid silencing of all forms of opposition. You know, the opposition party's bank accounts, the main opposition party, the Congress party's bank accounts were frozen, you know, which really seriously hampered their ability to campaign. On the other hand, we've had Modi putting an electoral bond mechanism, which basically enabled his party to be donated lots of huge sums of money anonymously and over the last, you know, the last elections, but also towards this election. And that has now been declared unconstitutional, but actually it's too late. We have this huge kind of alliance between media, which is run by corporate houses, which are cozy with the Modi regime. So we have very much we have a silencing of any kind of opposition that's been going on quite violently in India at the moment. So I think many people are rightly questioning whether this is a free and fair election.
That was Alpa Shah speaking to me earlier today. And as I said, the Indian election is going on for 6 weeks. So I'm planning to sort of do a lot more coverage of Indian politics and society because, you know, it's the world's most populous nation. I don't think we talk about it enough on this show. So I'm going to use this as an excuse to myself to really understand India a bit more and hopefully you guys as well. Let's go straight on to our next story. Over 100 students have been arrested at an Ivy League university for protesting Israel. This was the moment the NYPD swooped in to begin arresting people taking part in a Palestine solidarity encampment at Columbia University in New York.
Yeah.
The encampment was on a university lawn, which traditionally houses protests, so responding with 100 arrests seems incredibly heavy-handed. But the police were invited to make the arrests by the university leadership. And the details of the university's actions are pretty extraordinary. Rebecca Jordan-Young is a professor in gender studies at Barnard College, which is part of Columbia.
What we witnessed today was simply horrendous. It was astonishing to me. I have been an activist and I was a student protester in my undergrad days at Bryn Mawr. I was doing anti-apartheid organizing, and we faced hostility and condescension. We never faced the sort of thing that the students face today, which was a group of principled, peaceful, anti-war protesters having a massive phalanx of NYPD called on to them. They were first of all suspended in order to be able to charge them with trespassing. That suspension comes with all the things that Sheldon was talking about, removing their access to their own dorm rooms, locking them out from their belongings, telling them that they no longer had access to classes, and removing their access even to campus, which obviously was the pretense under which they could then be arrested for trespassing.
So that is amazing. Sort of the level of collaboration with the New York police, not only to call the cops on these protesters, but to create the circumstances in which they are breaking the law, right? So they say, well, these are all students. They're camping out on the grass. That might be against university policy. I think they said that there were some university, I'm not sure what the university policies were, but in theory, it's against the university policies, but they're not breaking the law. So they have to manufacture a situation in which they're breaking the law. And they do that by suspending all of these students who then get arrested for trespass, which is, these are kids, right? It's like 18, 19, 20 year olds. Like, it seems just completely out of order. Rebecca Jordan-Young wasn't the only professor outraged by what had happened. Stephanie McCurry is a professor in history at Columbia. You can see here a picture, a line of cops. And she says, "My campus, my neighborhood, Columbia under police control today, sacrificing everything a university stands for to satisfy a bunch of right-wing politicians." In an email to students and faculty, this is how the university president, Manoush Shafiq, explained her decision to call the cops. So she said, "To the Columbia University community, this morning I had to make a decision that I hoped would never be necessary. I have always said that the safety of our community was my top priority and that we needed to preserve an environment where everyone could learn in a supportive context. Out of an abundance of concern for the safety of Columbia's campus, I authorized the New York Police Department to begin clearing the encampment from the South Lawn of Morningside campus and that had been set up by students in the early hours of Wednesday morning." It's only been there a day and a half. She called the NYPD. Later in the email, she said this: "Protests have a storied history at Columbia and are an essential component of free speech in America and on our campus. But we work hard to balance the rights of students to express political views with the need to protect other students from rhetoric that amounts to harassment and discrimination. We updated our protest policy to allow demonstrations on very short notice and in prime locations in the middle of campus, while still allowing students to get to class and labs and libraries to operate. The current encampment violates all of the new policies, severely disrupts campus life, and creates a harassing and intimidating environment for many of our students." Now, Manoush Shafiq is right about one thing. There is a storied history of protests at Columbia University. Some of the most high-profile protests of 1968 against the Vietnam War took place there. But Manoush Shafiq has appeared very keen to appease the current panic about pro-Palestinian activism on campus. In a congressional hearing the day before calling the NYPD, she named professors who were under investigation for anti-Israel speech and condemned the phrase "from the river to the sea." And she had this rather bizarre exchange with a Republican congressman from Georgia.
"Are you familiar with Genesis 12:3?
Probably not as well as you are, Congressman.
Well, it's pretty clear it was the covenant that God made with Abraham. And that covenant was real clear. If you bless Israel, I will bless you. If you curse Israel, I will curse you. And then in the New Testament, it was confirmed that all nations would be blessed through you. So you do not know about that?
I have heard that. Now that you've explained it, yes, so I have heard that before.
It's now familiar. Do you consider that a serious issue? I mean, do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God of the Bible?
Definitely not.
Now, it's unclear whether Shafiq calling the cops on her students was driven by any desire to stay on the right side of God. In any case, though, it hasn't suddenly made Columbia a Zionist's paradise. Following the arrest of the original pro-Palestine protesters, many more came to take their place. This was part of a live stream from Thursday night from Breakthrough News.
The repression has only increased the turnout, and I think it's increased the frustration with the school administration that Manoush Shafiq has broken, over 50 years of precedent of not allowing the NYPD on campus. She has broken with that and authorized the arrest of her own students. And, you know, it's obviously because of the pressure that she's been facing with this congressional hearing, getting grilled in the U.S. Congress, being told everything but, you know, fire the professors that support Palestine. So, you know, we're really in unprecedented territory. This is the banner from the first encampment, which I guess was preserved somehow because everything at that encampment was destroyed.
Aaron, I want your take on this. I mean, this is like calling the NYPD on, you know, if they had, I mean, it would be wrong if they had occupied like a really important student building. Like when we were at university, we occupied a library. I think it was probably a mistake in hindsight. We should have occupied something else. But you could see how that was disruptive. These people were just occupying like a patch of lawn, and she suspended them so as to make it the case, so as to change the facts on the ground so that they were breaking the law, and then called the NYPD to arrest over 100 students. It doesn't seem normal to me.
Yeah, I've got so much to say about this, Michael. You know, I was involved in a few student occupations in my time. The most effective was when we occupied the university finance wing at the same time that lecturers were on strike, because then, of course, no payments can be done. You can't run a university. So we were there for multiple days, and it made a big difference. Like you say, this is out in the College Green. It's obviously got an impact. It's very good. It's very worthwhile. But it's not shutting down the running of the university in the way that, you know, even lecture theatre occupations or library occupations would. And like you said, it was just 1.5 days. If this had been like the University of Glasgow occupation in 2010, 2011, Michael, I mean, my God, they went on for 8 months. Of course, I would never, ever, ever endorse the police doing something like this. But you can go, okay, wow, they had a good crack. I mean, by the way, also, the police tried to do something like that in Glasgow. It didn't work. That's how good the University of Glasgow occupation was. I think actually the police tried to shut it down and it just got bigger. So what the facts on the ground are that Columbia University has clearly a zero tolerance policy on protest. But they're not saying that. I mean, if you're not letting people do this for more than 1.5 days, you call in the police, you arrest 100 people. That's utterly extraordinary, especially, as you've said, for a university like Columbia, which tries to sell as part of its brand almost this apparent commitment to free speech and dissent and protest. I always found this very funny. You know, you'd have people being shown around University College London, where I studied, and they would say it's founded by Jeremy Bentham on dissenting principles, radical enlightenment, liberal ideas from the early 19th century. It wasn't a conservative or reactionary university. They're saying all that stuff, you know, and a week earlier, they've closed down university occupation, or they've stopped a protest, or they're very upset that people are protesting about certain workers being outsourced or being given 0 hours contracts. These people see it as part of their brand, but they don't seem to be able to join the dots, how convenient, between quote-unquote that brand, the history of that institution, and how those same values should be embodied in the present politically. So that's one point. And I mentioned the point as well about the fact that, you know, the police going in here really is pretty big. I mean, it happened, I think, in Kent State in the 60s. 6 people were actually killed, I think. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. There was massive police intimidation of university campuses in the 60s. That did happen. But the Northeast, as I understand it, was pretty good. New York State was pretty good. And in particular, Michael, that clip we just saw of an American politician basically saying to this lady that you have to respect Israel. I mean, I want to do a TikTok about this, by the way. He's referring to Christian Zionist translations of the Bible, which are really, they are generated in the 19th century. There's one particular Bible which basically starts to translate. There's a part where God says to Abraham, Jacob becomes Israel. He doesn't mean a literal political entity like the state of Israel. Bear in mind, this is a, you know, when this is being, when this is emerging, the Christian Zionist movement, it's 100 years before the state of Israel. It's before Theodor Herzl. It's before the idea of sort of European Zionism even emerges. You have these new translations amongst American evangelical Christians, Protestant sects, saying that actually a necessary precondition for the return of Christ is the restoration of a kingdom of Israel. And those Bibles had an impact to this day. I mean, you've got literally an elected politician, somebody with political power in the United States, referring to one of those stupid, dumb, mistranslated Bibles, which were a political intervention by people at the time. But it really does say something quite unique, Michael, about Christian Zionism, that, you know, this was not started yesterday. And how when you involve yourself in publication or translation of certain documents, particularly religious ones, the consequences of that can echo for centuries. Just remarkable, the idea that you can translate in a different way a Bible, and 150 years later, you have somebody like this numbskull telling some university bureaucrat that she can't allow a protest at the campus for that very reason. Absolutely absurd. And also, Michael, finally, you know, the United States is a country which has free speech, free assembly. These things are enshrined in law. It tries to pride itself on its constitutional rights. And yet, as I said a moment ago, there is this zero tolerance approach. I think it says something quite significant about the sort of liberal, quote unquote, progressive class in the United States right now as well. I mean, these are the people that 3-4 years ago were hiring, you know, DEI staff, that were taking the knee in solidarity with Black Lives Matter, those kinds of milieus, people that work in university management, and not all of them, of course, but it was a thing to be seen as embodying progressive values. That's clearly not the case with regards to Israel-Palestine, clearly, evidently, from what we've seen with Colombia, for several reasons. Quickly, the academic that we spoke to a moment ago on that interview clip, she said that there was an attitude almost of condescension to students when they protested in yesteryear. Well, the reason why they were condescended to is because fundamentally, without being rude, they didn't have a huge impact on US foreign policy. That was the case in the Vietnam War in the 60s and the 70s. But it wasn't really, and she said apartheid, of course, but it wasn't really the case in the 80s, the 90s, or sadly even the 2000s with the war in Iraq. University activism, student activism did not have a massive impact on US foreign policy like it did in the 60s and the 70s. I think now we're clearly entering a moment in the United States where young people across all walks of life, universities, workplaces, just protests, just generally, culture, cultural production, clearly I think there is a consensus now amongst younger people, particularly in cities, that actually the status quo with regards to US foreign policy on Israel-Palestine is kind of screwed up, and they'd like to see it changed. That's a significant threat to a whole bunch of vested interests. So this shift that you're seeing generally beyond Colombia in terms of the policing of dissent in the United States in regards to people protesting effectively US foreign policy, giving Israel $14 billion aid packages whilst there is a genocide happening in Gaza, that shift is happening for a reason, because those protests are being effective, because frankly, the political class isn't insulated from popular accountability in the same way it was 20, 30, even 40 years ago.
Yeah, I should clarify, the gender studies professor you heard from, we hadn't actually done the interview with her. I saw this clip sort of going around on Twitter. I assume it was from some sort of Zoom meeting somewhere, but I couldn't attribute it because I couldn't work out where it had originated from. But I can definitely confirm that she is a professor of gender studies at Barnard, which is connected to Colombia. In terms of Kent State, I was looking that up while you were talking, Aaron. Four people were killed at Kent State. That was in 1970. They were killed by Ohio National Guards protesting Vietnam. In Colombia, Columbia University in New York, some of the big protests were in 1968. No one was killed, but the cops did come and beat up quite a lot of people. So potentially more violent than what we saw yesterday. But as far as I understand, I've just been reading about this today, I'm no expert, that was so controversial that the Columbia University administration sort of set out a more progressive policy on protests because they didn't want to see sort of another situation where you've got NYPD arresting students on campus. So I think there has been a sort of stable equilibrium since 1968. I think that's what the gentleman was talking about in that breakthrough news clip where he was sort of saying for 50 years they haven't been calling the NYPD to pick up protesters, and now suddenly that's changed. As you say, Aaron, I think that's a lot to do with, you know, the nature of Israel as a political topic in America. It can't sort of unite liberals in the same way that some other issues have in recent years. Also, I think those hearings in Congress have been really significant. You're seeing a real significant sort of counterattack from Republicans being very aggressive, getting university administrators in front of them, and then trying to catch them out on television. And we saw this, you know, way back sort of late last year, where you had the presidents of Harvard, Pennsylvania, and MIT, I think. And because you had administrators who basically held the line, they sort of said, look, we're a university that practices free speech. If someone is being abusive, then yes, that breaks our rules. But if they're expressing an opinion, then we believe in free speech. They did answer the questions in a somewhat clunky way, but they were, I suppose, manipulated in this act of political theater. Two of the three of them resigned. And so Manoush Shafiq from Columbia, she seems to have decided that she's going to go in there. And instead of sort of holding the line like those ones, she's saying, I'm not losing my job here. So she goes there and basically just agrees with everything the Republicans say, which seems to have been the case here. And then the following day, she's called the cops on 100 students. So it does seem like this congressional hearing they're having on, I think it's on anti-Semitism on campus, is very effective in sort of putting the heebie-jeebies into people who would probably otherwise be liberal presidents of universities to clamp down on free speech if it is pro-Palestine. Because of course, on campuses, the vast majority of people in that age group are going to be very critical of Israel. So if you want to try and sort of shift the dial in campuses, it's going to have to be in an authoritarian top-down way, because you are not winning the argument in that demographic. Right, let's go to our next story, and a warning, it contains graphic content. While the world has been holding its breath at the prospect of an all-out war between Israel and Iran, Palestinians in Gaza are still suffering the daily killings meted out by the IDF. Since October the 7th, Israel has killed 13,000 children in Gaza, and CNN has had a powerful and distressing report this week about 8 more Palestinian children killed.
A moment frozen in time. The bodies of at least 4 children splayed around a foosball table. Laughter and shrieks of joy silenced in an instant. Blood now marking where they stood only minutes earlier. Shahid, no way. Shahid, my beloved, her cousin screams from behind the camera. 10-year-old Shahid is one of those children. Her bright pink pants unmistakable in the arms of the man carrying her away. With her family's consent, CNN has decided to show Shahid in life and death in order to give a face to this war's deadly impact on children. At Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, those who can still be saved arrive alongside those who cannot. Amid the chaos, Shahid's pink pants dangling as a doctor confirms what is tragically obvious. But Shahid is not alone. She is one of 8 children who died on that crowded street in Al-Maghazi. The hospital says they were killed in an Israeli airstrike. The Israeli military said the incident is under review. One after another, their small bodies arrive at the hospital's morgue and into the arms of grieving parents. His eyes swollen and red, the father of 9-year-old Lujain recounts his daughter's last moments, playing foosball with her friends. This is my eldest daughter, he says. A drone strike hit them while they were playing. They're all children.
Obviously, that footage is just so tragic and horrific in and of itself. I have to say that that last clip gave me a sort of even, you know, a somewhat more abstract concern, which is, what does Israel expect to happen? And, you know, if you are killing a man's daughter while she's playing table football with a drone, right, then that man is going to passionately hate you for the rest of his life, the rest of his life with a passion, right? This is not going to be resentment towards Israel. This is going to be a furious hatred. And if Israel think that, you know, they can keep doing this and not suffer the consequences of all this anger they're creating, that does make me think, you know, are they going to try and get these people out of Gaza? Because how can you sort of cause this much pain and suffering to so many people and live next door to them? Because they're going to be so goddamn angry at you, rightfully. So it does make me worry that maybe Israel is saying, well, it's fine to make them this angry because we're going to ethnically cleanse them anyway. They're not going to be next door to us. It just seems to me that it would be a strange policy for the Israelis to say, yes, of course, long term, we're going to get rid of Hamas, but these people will live here. And ultimately, we'll try and make Gaza a sort of reasonable place to live once Hamas are gone. And then maybe people won't be so angry at us anymore. That seems to be what sort of the United States, the United Kingdom want to pretend is going on here. But if you are, for a six-month period, killing people's daughters with drones while they play table football, then, you know, I don't even believe Israel are going to try and make Gaza a livable place and sort of get some Gulf money investment in there. But even if you did, even if they sort of followed this war with the most enlightened, benign policies imaginable, those people are never going to stop hating you, which, you know, makes me feel like there must be people in the Israeli government who are saying it's fine because they're not going to be there anyway. You know, we're going to get rid of them. Anyway, if you're wondering why lots of that clip was sort of blurred out, it's because YouTube is quite strict, really, on what you can show. There's the original version of this clip is on Twitter, and it's very, very graphic, which I think was quite a sort of conscious decision made by CNN to sort of say, we are going to show you the faces of dead kids, essentially. Really horrific to look at, very, very powerful. And we're going to go back to a bit more of that report.
Hours earlier, Yusuf was one of those children, playing alongside Shahed and Lujain when he was suddenly killed in a war he did not choose, his mother still clinging to her son. Neither does this boy, who cannot believe his brother is dead. He is still alive, he cries. Don't leave him here. Amid the outpourings of grief, there is Shahid, her blood-stained pink pants, once again impossible to miss. Dear God, what did they all do? One man cries. What did they all do?
Aaron, I want your thoughts on that clip. I mean, there's, I suppose, the horror that's sort of depicted in it, and then the fact that this is going out on like a really mainstream American broadcaster. This is, you know, we're 6 months now after October the 7th. I think there was, you know, some, I mean, we didn't, but I think there were some sort of, you know, liberal people in the United States or the West who sort of immediately after October the 7th, they'd see these horrific images and they'd say, well, you know, Israel are angry because of October the 7th. So, you know, some of their kids were killed as well. This happens. It's been 6 months and Israel is still killing groups of children with drones who are playing table football.
Yeah, I saw an image of a young child, a toddler. I mean, it's awful just to even talk about it, Michael, who had 200 stitches in his body, 200 stitches across his face, across his torso, his arm, 200 stitches, just scarred for life. Obviously, he's lucky to be alive. But besides the fatalities here, and those are the figures we keep on hearing, 13,000 dead children and so on, it could be significantly higher. It may be slightly lower. Of course, this is a war zone, and it's very difficult to get entirely accurate data because there's just so many buildings have collapsed and, you know, lines of communication aren't exactly the best they could be. But clearly, thousands of children have died. Many more thousands of children are disfigured, suffering from PTSD, I mean, obviously, disabled. Their lives will be changed because of what's happened over the last 6 months. Even if this, I'd call it a war, it's not a war because it's so entirely one-sided. If this genocide stopped tomorrow, it is a war on children. And I say that to people, and I think actually, like you say, Michael, it's really cut through now. There are people who, in the immediate aftermath of October the 7th, I might share something from Navarra Media on Instagram, or I might, you know, share a clip from us here on Navarro Live or whatever. And I have some friends who are not very left-wing. You know, people I've known over, I'm 40 years old, over 20 years of my life, obviously you meet many people who politically disagree with you. Some of them are good people, you know, some maybe not. But, you know, there would be people who I would think of as good, decent people who might not be that familiar with the conflict and who are like, this is ridiculous, what you're saying is outrageous, et cetera, et cetera. And I think part of my job, our job, part of the reason of Navarro Media is to persuade those people otherwise and to get the facts to them. But what's interesting is, Michael, that those people have stopped. Those people have stopped. And now I've got one person in mind in particular who's got a young daughter. And I said to him, I said, look, this is a war on children. I find it extraordinary that you as a father could defend this. Of course, you don't need to have children to care. But I was trying to appeal to his better side, his better instincts. And I don't really see how you have a tangible answer to that, Michael. Of course, October 7th was horrific. Of course, there's been massive failures of political leadership on all sides for a very long time. You know, some people have said to me, Israel want the two-state solution. I say, when? And they say, well, 1923, 1945. I mean, Christ's sake, come on, 1948? This is ridiculous. Israel has not wanted with any real meaning a two-state solution for decades. You could argue Oslo Accords, Yitzhak Rabin, was it a plausible state? Not really. And the victims of this are the children. I think in Gaza, Michael, you'll know this better than I will. I think about 50% of the population is younger than 18. So when you hear this claim that they voted for Hamas in the last free and fair elections in the mid-2000s, the best part of two decades ago, I mean, no, actually, many of them hadn't even been born. This is all they've known, this giant human ghetto, this prison, this open air prison in Gaza, and now, of course, this extraordinary conflict. And I would also say, Michael, just as an ancillary point to what you said there, what's the political point of doing this? You know, obviously, what Israel does to Iran with the killing of civilian scientists, I find it reprehensible. It's disgusting. It breaks international law, of course. But you understand they want to obstruct Iran developing nuclear weapons. They want to ensure Iran's military-industrial complex can't develop, that they can't technologically develop. I understand. What's the benefit of killing all these children, disfiguring all these children? As we said at the start of the conflict, you know, every child that dies is a recruiting sergeant for Hamas. And actually, I don't even think it's fair to say Hamas. I think forces far different, far more violent than Hamas will recruit people who lose children, loved ones, parents from this conflict. And so I think the only way you can make sense of it, Michael, is if it's A, malicious and they literally don't care, B, they view these people as subhuman, so not worthy of human dignity or the right to life, but then C, and finally, I think this is really important, we need to get our head around that probably the majority of Israeli civil society, because of course they have to speak out both sides of their mouth when it comes to the Israeli political class, because you can't say this, but the majority of Israeli civil society favor greater Israel. And they don't want Palestinians in it. And as I said, about half an hour ago, Israel Katz is a great example here. He is far from a marginal figure. He's the country's foreign secretary. He would like to see Israel take over the West Bank as part of a greater Israel and give Gaza to the Egyptians. You know, he doesn't want those people, those children, in this state. That's the only way it makes sense, because you don't kill people's parents or children if you think that you're going to have to govern their descendants, because like you say, that's a very messy business that often doesn't work out very well. And the kinds of things we've seen over the last 6 months, Michael, that takes 50, 60, 70, 100 years to heal. And even then it can be hard.
You know, I think that is absolutely right. Let's wrap up there. Aaron, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
My pleasure, Michael. I do love our Friday shows.
And thank you so much for watching. We'll be back, of course, on Monday at 6 p.m. For now, have a great weekend. You've been watching Navarro Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarro Media. Go to navarromedia.com/support.